This week on COVID, Race and Democracy.
We are working with partners, including tech and media companies and member states, to identify and deploy the best tools to better detect and counter mis and disinformation and hate speech.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres pledges to work with tech and media companies to control UN peacekeeping narratives.
The role of the mainstream press, which is spreading all these lies, which is the most prolific disseminator of disinformation on the planet, is seeking to distract us from what our predator class at home is actually doing to us.
Max Blumenthal and Aaron Maté, speaking in Toronto, explain why mainstream media is the most prolific source of disinformation on the planet.
But really, this is the time for the government to step up and protect these really basic rights of individuals that is going to be affecting not just them personally, but their families and possibly generations to come.
Women who seek abortions in states that ban them, or women who travel out of states that ban abortion to seek abortions, may be surveilled and prosecuted. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. Today's show is part four of our series on censorship and surveillance. The United Nations Security Council formally joined the war on independent media last week when UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres addressed the Council on, quote, strategic communication, unquote, to counter, quote, misinformation, disinformation, and hate speech that are being used as weapons of war, unquote.
Peacekeepers are facing terrorists, criminals, armed groups and their allies, many with access to powerful modern weapons and many with a vested interest in perpetuating the chaos in which they thrive. The weapons they wield are not just guns and explosives. Misinformation, disinformation and hate speech are increasingly being used as weapons of war.
Guterres also said that UN peacekeeping missions will work with tech and media companies.
We are working with partners, including tech and media companies and member states, to identify and deploy the best tools to better detect and counter mis and disinformation and hate speech.
Like most official critics of, quote, misinformation, disinformation, and hate speech, unquote, Guterres failed to address the question of who has the moral or intellectual authority to decide what is misinformation, disinformation, and hate speech. Or rather, he simply assumed that he does. The Democratic Republic of the Congo, also known as DRC, has the largest, most long-standing peacekeeping mission in the world, in place since 1999. But there is no peace, and the never-ending war in DRC is worsening once again, with the M23 militia resurfacing to attack the people of Congo's Kivu provinces again. M23 is a Rwandan militia recruited and commanded by top officials in the Rwandan government, as was proven 10 years ago in 2012 by that year's UN Group of Experts report on DRC. Nevertheless, the lie that M23 is a Congolese militia has resurfaced as well. Rwanda's war in DRC violates the first principle of international law, the sovereignty of nations, and the UN Security Council therefore has the authority to organize a multilateral force to stop it. The lie, aka disinformation, that M23 is a Congolese militia has nevertheless provided cover for the peacekeeping mission's failure for the last 23 years.
Thank you.
Next, we hear from the Gray Zone's Max Blumenthal and Aaron Mate. At the Collision Tech Conference in Toronto in June of this year, they explained how the mainstream media is the most prolific source of disinformation on the planet, working closely with the national security state to cultivate public support for war while deflecting scrutiny from the oligarchy that controls it. The moderator is Martina Fuchs of the Xinhua News Agency.
First of all, let me ask the editor-in-chief here next to me, Max, what was the motivation to set Grayzone up about 8 years ago now?
Well, in short, there was nowhere else I could do the reporting that we do, because by the time I set it up as a fully independent entity in 2018, the mainstream press in the U.S. had been fully consolidated as essentially an arm of the intelligence services, the national security state, and what we aim to do, which is what journalists like Cy Hirsch, our friend, traditionally did, is to expose the deceptions that are taking us into these disastrous wars, which are now wrecking our economy and possibly imperiling all your startups. It's something that the mainstream media now, echoing Joe Biden as his little band of stenographers, is calling the Putin price hike. And for doing the kind of reporting we do, no one debates us. They don't challenge us on the facts. What they do, and Aaron's going to address this, is they try to deplatform us, they try to censor us, and they claim that me and Putin made a deal to set up the Gray Zone. They also say, you know, I mean, this is the mainstream press, the one that's freaking out about disinformation. You've had a lot of panels here on disinformation. They also said that Putin paid bounties to the Taliban to kill U.S. troops. The New York Times reported that, as if the Taliban needed extra incentive to get rid of occupiers that had been there for 20 years. They said that Putin fabricated the existence of Hunter Biden's laptop, as if the Biden family couldn't be completely corrupt with business deals in China and Ukraine. They said that Putin helped, Kamala Harris, the VP, said that Putin helped launch the anti-racism protests of Colin Kaepernick, while CNN reported that Putin is spreading racism in the United States. I mean, Putin is being blamed now by a member of parliament in the UK named Tobias Elwood for the British rail strikes. So what's going on here? Why is Putin being blamed for everything? It's because the role of the mainstream press, which is spreading all these lies, which is the most prolific disseminator of disinformation on the planet, is seeking to distract us from what our predator class at home is actually doing to us, to divide us and destroy our economic livelihoods. Mm. And so
these
we exist to do something else.
These are quite hard lines. Now, talk about censorship, right, Aaron? You must have come really under attack for exactly defending your, editorial guidelines, right? Tell me about how that came about.
Just recently at the Gray Zone, we obtained some leaks from a British journalist named Paul Mason, who claims to
About a British journalist.
About a British,
yeah, mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. But these emails came from the emails of Paul Mason. He was sending, and basically, he was plotting with some colleagues and some contacts inside the British national security state to have us deplatformed. And there's a long conversation about it, and there's can't go into details. But basically, nowhere in these exchanges does it occur to them, if we don't agree with the Gray Zone, why don't we just write an article debunking them? They've put out a bunch of reporting. We cover all sorts of topics, you know, Russia, Syria, Ukraine, China. Put out an article refuting us based on facts. That's what intellectually honest people do.
These emails expose a prominent British journalist working with someone in the UK Foreign Office who is an intelligence officer, Andy Price, to get us removed from all social media platforms and removed from PayPal, as other alternative media outlets like Mint Press and Consortium News were, simply because he doesn't like our opinions on the NATO proxy war in Ukraine. That's
so
where we're at right now.
Guys, Gray Zone basically means standing between black and white. Would you really stand between different sides, or are you basically always taking the counter side? It seems to me like you're against all mainstream media and just, for everything else.
We have our political views. I mean, I personally identify with the left, I always have, but the facts are the facts. And journalism was once considered a trade where the facts come first. Mm-hmm. But in this environment where essentially our journalism is controlled by the same people who control our society.
So are you only fact-based, or are you opinionated and do you write commentaries and all that?
We have our opinions, but the facts always come first. Mm-hmm. And what makes us stand out, I think, is that so many of our colleagues, unfortunately, have abandoned that tradition of not putting the facts mm-hmm. first. And you know, look, the most hilarious example to me was when for 4 years it was fashionable in the U.S. to believe that the president of the U.S. was a Russian asset and was being compromised with P-tapes and other forms of blackmail. It was transparently ridiculous, it was a scam, but everybody went along with it. Not because I think they actually believed it, but because that was the dominant partisan narrative of that time, and we were above that.
I guess it's fair to say that most people here also in the audience and myself don't trust all the mainstream media because we have so many different platforms right now, social media, we get a lot of sources. Sometimes it's, of course, an overflow of news as well. So it's really important that we select wisely and we make our judgment afterwards. But would you say that the trust in the mainstream media will decline further from here, or has it reached the lowest point already?
Hopefully it will. People need to see that the mainstream media has functioned as a mighty Wurlitzer for the policymakers that are engaged in a controlled demolition of our economy. A new survey reported by the Quincy Institute in Washington shows that U.S. media reported more on Ukraine, all with one voice, one message, one line, which was completely identical to the line of the Defense Department and the State Department, which is also the line of the Canadian government, more than it ever reported in any month on the U.S. assault on Iraq and Afghanistan. And so it's the mainstream media that's been driving what Congress now acknowledges is a NATO proxy war in Ukraine. And what has it led to? It has led to hyperinflation through the sanctioning of one of the world's largest exporters of oil. It has led to record gas prices. It's led to economic ruin on the horizon, a global recession, famine in the global south. And the media was telling you that Ukraine was going to win, the Russian economy would be ruined, these sanctions were just, and everything's going to be fine, and the public is not on board anymore. Maybe this is a bubble, and you don't feel that here, but go outside and talk to regular people, the people who are ignored and demonized by the Canadian media, like the people who are protesting in Ottawa who had their bank accounts seized, who are called hate mongers and white supremacists. Those people are not going to be happy.
There's so many reasons why the public has lost confidence in the media. I mean, we all remember Iraq WMDs. Even in the run-up to the 2020 election, some anonymous intelligence officials decided to say that Hunter Biden's laptop was just Russian disinformation, and that was enough for pretty much every single media outlet, with a few exceptions, to say, okay, we're not going to cover it. And then now we have to acknowledge, oh yeah, right, we were wrong about that. Mm-hmm. But there's so many examples of this, and so when it happens enough times, no wonder people are losing trust. You know, and by the way, there are stories that the media won't even cover that we cover, like the OPCW cover-up scandal, which is a story about an alleged chemical attack in Syria, and then you had the world's top chemical weapons watchdog go and investigate it. Their own investigators found no evidence of that, but they were censored. We've gotten leaks from that investigation and we report on it. The rest of the media won't even acknowledge the existence of these whistleblowers. And so when you have enforced censorship like that from the media outlets themselves, people are going to lose trust and go to alternative sources.
I remember when Al Jazeera launched in Qatar, one of their main mottos and goals was Al-Ray wal-Ray al-Akhar, you understand probably, one opinion and the other opinion. It's always important, of course, to show all sides of the story. But to me, it seems that your work is activist journalism, right? You don't want to just show the second side of the story. So what is your ultimate goal, Max?
All the mainstream media are activist journalists. They are activists for neoliberal capitalism and for the political establishment. That's why they spend hours and hours on January 6th instead of doing hours and hours of reporting in the trenches in Appalachia of people who are dying of opioid deaths and being flooded with this poison. There are so many issues they could be talking about. Why are they talking about January 6th constantly? It's because they are activists for their cause. And we are transparent about what we believe. So you can trust that we have these beliefs. For that reason, we're accused of disinformation. There was actually a speaker yesterday from a group called the Institute for Strategic Dialogue, funded by the UK and US governments, that has published a paper accusing Aaron of being one of the most prolific spreaders of disinformation on the globe on the issue of Syria, but they never pointed out one piece of disinformation. They've refused our request for an interview.
But just that claim itself is enough for an outlet like The Guardian, a mainstream outlet, to then repeat that study, to do an article about it, and repeat the claim that I spread disinformation without identifying a single case where I actually allegedly spread disinformation.
Right. So, Aaron, are you getting death threats? Have you come under attack, physical, verbal attacks?
No. I mean, I'm fortunate not to have faced, for example, what Julian Assange is facing right now, where he's being caged and tortured because he is really the foremost person in the world of exposing Western state crimes. And he's actually a great example of what we're talking about. When you really do your job as a journalist, when you educate humanity about the inhumanity of our rulers, they are going to pour down on you all the inhumanity that they have. And that's why he's now stuck in a prison and facing possible extradition to the U.S.
And let's be clear, WikiLeaks has never published anything false. They've never published a false document, and that's why he's jailed. That's why the Biden administration is seeking to extradite him. That's why the Trump administration sought to poison him when he was trapped in an embassy in London. And that is why he is not only being demonized, but the rest of the media seems sort of disinterested in this case. This is the single press freedom case of our lifetime that will determine if the press will be free. And it seems to me that the corporate press is not very interested in Julian Assange because they don't want to bite the hand that feeds them, which is the intelligence services that are seeking to kill him.
That was Max Blumenthal and Aaron Mate of The Gray Zone speaking at the Collision Tech Conference in Toronto in June. There are ongoing actions in Washington, D.C. to free WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, who is facing extradition to the United States and 170 years in prison for publishing evidence of U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan. WPFW's Thomas O'Rourke has this report.
The president of Mexico, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, a.k.a. AMLO, announced before his recent visit to the White House on Tuesday, July 12th, that he would ask President Biden to direct the Department of Justice to suspend all prosecution of Julian Assange for journalism and publishing and withdraw the U.S.'s extradition request. The activist group DC Action for Assange took the initiative to write and hand-deliver a letter of thanks to AMLO, care of the Mexican embassy here in Washington. The letter pointed out the profound threat this case raises against journalism around the world and thanks AMLO for his vocal support. I spoke to Ann Wilcox for DC Action for Assange on Pennsylvania Avenue outside the Mexican embassy.
We came out to thank President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, sometimes called AMLO, because he'd expressed support for Julian Assange and said the U.S., if it was true to its principles, would drop the charges against Assange. He's a reporter and a publisher and an editor. And so AMLO basically condemned the U.S. And he said on the 4th of July something to the effect, I'll go tear down the Statue of Liberty unless you let Assange go and drop the extradition request. So we're just hoping he'll do that. And we have a local group, DC Action for Assange, that goes to Attorney General Merrick Garland's house every 2 weeks. And we have a little vigil outside his house, very peaceful, not noisy. And we try to remind him that we're there and we want to drop, you know, free Assange. And today we were thanking the president of Mexico. Now, I will say that I've heard that he talks radical, but he doesn't always act in a radical way.
Yes.
So we're hoping that he does, in fact, push the Biden administration to drop this extradition.
That was Ann Wilcox with DC Action for Assange, speaking to Thomas O'Rourke of WPFW Pacifica Radio in Washington, D.C. This is Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. One form of censorship becoming common is online tools like PayPal and GoFundMe freezing donations contributed to outlets like WikiLeaks, Mint Press News, and Consortium News, and or banning them from using the platforms. Here's Manar Adli, founder and executive editor of Mint Press News, speaking to RT.
Well, there's no question that PayPal banning myself and Mint Press and other journalists like Caleb Maupin is a form of blatant censorship of dissenting journalists and outlets. If you look at the kind of coverage that we produce at Mint Press, for the past decade, we have been unapologetically working as a watchdog journalism outlet, which is how journalism is supposed to operate, according to our First Amendment, to hold those in power account, to expose the profiteers of the permanent war state. And we've done this from the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, to apartheid Israel's occupation of Palestine, Sudan, to Saudi Arabia's genocidal war in Yemen, to the regime change operations in Syria, Ukraine, and Venezuela, where U.S. weapons have flooded these nations to plunge them into devastating civil wars. You know, we're living right now in an intellectual no-fly zone, which is what we've named it, where online censorship of dissenting journalism has become the new norm. The U.S. sanctions regime that is trying to starve Russia, Venezuela, Zimbabwe, Cuba, Iran, and over 25% of the world's population is now targeting its own citizens with its maximum pressure campaign. So we are forced to toe the official government line in order to survive as a journalist in America today.
So what do you think this says about the U.S. government and its efforts to stifle opposition voices?
Absolutely. And we saw the blueprint of this happen when we saw the backlash against Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. I mean, when PayPal first blocked WikiLeaks from receiving donations, that became the blueprint for today's censorship of dissenting voices. And we saw that in 2012, an EU parliamentary resolution criticized providers of big tech like PayPal about this arbitrary economic censorship. So WikiLeaks was the first victim, opening the floodgates to the kind of censorship, financial censorship, we're seeing now against other dissenting journalists. And, you know, we have to look at the era that we're living in now. We're living in an era of a declining US empire. Censorship has become the last resort of an unpopular regime and its forever wars to make the truth disappear and critical thinking all but dead. Right now, the war in Ukraine is raging on, and we've entered wartime. And so the crackdown on dissent is really taking is really big. It's happening really big right now. Big tech giants, including PayPal, are working hand in hand with the architects of the war in Ukraine, the new Cold War with Russia, who are funded by NATO to sanction journalists like ourselves. So if you go read the board of any of these big tech giants from Google, Twitter, Facebook, and even PayPal, they read like a rogue gallery of warmongers and criminals that brought us the devastating wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and turning Libya into a failed state where slaves are literally being sold on the streets. And so these are the same people that have no problem with the U.S. flooding Ukraine with millions of dollars worth of weapons. And in many times, these weapons end up in the hands of Nazis with the Azov battalion. So their agenda is very clear. It's to control the free flow of information and target the bank accounts of anyone who dares not only to question the official narrative, but to offer an alternative narrative to the Pentagon and the State Department.
So how much say do you think that those who own tech giants have in U.S. governmental policy? And are they powerful enough to silence dissenting voices?
They absolutely are. I mean, if you look at PayPal, who founded it, it's one of the founders is Peter Thiel. He's a founder. He's a billionaire. And he sits right now on the board of Meta, of Facebook. And part of his work has always been to target whistleblowers and truth tellers. Another founder of PayPal is billionaire Pierre Omidyar, who is very much embedded with the Democratic Party, people like Hillary Clinton and the Obama administration that helped create the current crisis in Ukraine that we're seeing today. And so if you look at even some of the think tanks that these big tech giants are working with, like the Atlantic Council, they're directly funded by NATO. And they work with fake news flaggers who fight, you know, Russian disinformation, of course, like the Anti-Defamation League, which is also known as the ADL, which is a major supporter of apartheid Israel. Another person is Elmore. She is the information minister for Israel. She also sits on the so-called free speech board of Facebook. And these people are responsible for removing hundreds of thousands of Palestinian posts off of these social media platforms and other dissenting coverage about Yemen or the wars in Iraq and the victims that have been targeted by U.S. sanctions. And so they absolutely do have very much a lot of control over what can be published and what can't, and who is allowed to be on these platforms and who can't as well.
That was Munar Adli, founder and executive editor of Mint Press News, discussing recent financial censorship of dissident journalism by PayPal.
Come, you masters of war, you that built the big guns, you that built the death planes, you that built all of the bombs, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind desks. I just want you to know I can see behind your masks. Yeah. You that never done nothing but built to destroy. You play with my world like it's your little.
That was the Roots interpretation of Bob Dylan's Masters of War. This is Pacifica's Covered Race in Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. Jackson Hinkle is a YouTube journalist whose work has been demonetized by the platform, which identified his work as, quote, misinformation, disinformation, and hate speech, unquote. Here's Hinkle speaking to his audience shortly after he got the news.
7 days ago, I was suspended from YouTube. YouTube is my main streaming platform. It always has been. It always will be, hopefully. And this is because I was also banned from Twitch several months ago because I said that there was U.S.-funded biolabs in Ukraine, something that at the time, you know, earned me the label from Twitch of being a harmful misinformation actor, up until the point 2 weeks later when Victoria Nuland, Deputy Secretary of State, came out and the Pentagon came out and said that, yes, the U.S. was funding and operating dozens of biolabs in Ukraine. And yes, they were working on high-level pathogens in these biolabs. But that's neither here nor there, because that was a while ago, and that was that. That was the past. And I've been streaming on YouTube for the past several months, and everything's been going great, actually. I mean, we've had record viewership here. We've been averaging, 6-7 million views a month on YouTube alone. We've reached 124,000 subscribers, and it's really been incredible. Our videos have been getting 30 to 100,000 views on average. It's really been incredible, and I thank you so much for all the support. Unfortunately, we were suspended for the past 7 days, but that's not the main story here. Okay, so keep watching, because it gets even worse. On the fourth or fifth day of my suspension, I don't really remember, because I was just so shocked, and I still am so shocked as to this news, I got a second email from the TOS, the Terms of Service Community Guidelines team at YouTube. Now, who are these people? We don't know who these people are. Sometimes they say a video is okay to be on YouTube, and then the next day they'll switch and say it's not okay to be on YouTube, and they'll take it down. I would imagine these are the sorts of people who graduate from Boston College or Yale. They have pink or blue hair, and they were born with a silver spoon in their mouth, and now they live in Silicon Valley, where they dictate for the rest of the entire nation what acceptable or unacceptable speech is. Well, I got a second email from them. This email, with a harsher tone, notified me that I had been permanently demonetized on YouTube. This means no super chats. This means no super thanks under any of my videos. This means no ad revenue from any of my videos. This means no memberships for any of you that choose to support me through that, through those means as well. This means I can't, you know, raid people on YouTube anymore either, which is something that I've helped grow other people's channels with. It's a feature that is really beneficial, because we've been getting, you know, 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 people watching our live streams, and then we can send them over to another streamer that has a similar, you know, point of view as us, and we build our audiences. Okay. So, if you don't get the big picture here, that amounts for, I'm guessing, maybe like 80% of my income. Yeah. So what would you do if, you know, all of a sudden you were doing your job, you were following all the rules of your work, and then for some reason, you know, your boss comes in and tells you that they're going to reduce your pay by 80%. Me, I don't know. It just pisses me off and kind of fires me up even more. Like, everyone's like, are you okay? Yeah, I'm okay. I'm just fired up to keep going even harder because, I mean, we at least still have our channel for now, right? And everyone's still watching.
That was Jackson Hinkle. YouTube comic Jimmy Dore and friends also responded to YouTube's decision to demonetize Hinkle's channel.
Yeah, what you're doing is you're going against the military-industrial complex, establishment figures, and, well, we've got to try to suppress you before you grow, because he was growing very fast. He went from zero to over 100,000 subscribers like that. Why? Because he was providing a service that the mainstream news media isn't providing, and neither is anyone else. He's telling the truth about what's happening with the Ukraine war. Black and the Empire says, after directions from the security state, YouTube has reviewed his videos and seen his channel grow to the point where they can no longer monetize his challenging the lies necessary for our government to continue their corruption. Wow, well said. Aaron Mate, Izzy award-winning independent journalist who debunked Russiagate, said Jackson has built a large following as a vocal critic of the U.S. proxy war in Ukraine. This move not only penalizes him for dissenting, but sends a chilling message to others who challenge or think about challenging the war state line. And that's why you don't think that other people have real doubts about our COVID policy. They're afraid to talk about them. I'm talking about other YouTubers who are in the space that we all occupy. They're afraid. That's why no one does any videos about them, because they're afraid of stuff like this happening, and you can't almost blame them. And same thing with what's going on with Syria, or what's going on with Venezuela when it was going on, or what's going on in Ukraine. You can't call Nazis, stuff like that. But you can call truckers Nazis all day long, and that's not hate speech. Here's what our good friend Caitlin Johnstone says. She says, people aren't grasping the significance of the fact that Silicon Valley is now shutting down content creators, not because they allegedly harm the public good, but because they disagree with the United States government about a war. Ukraine censorship is a wildly unprecedented escalation, and it is. Imagine, you know what they would have been doing down the Iraq war. They would be censoring anybody who said they didn't have weapons of mass destruction. They would be censored. You'd be censored. You'd be called a conspiracy theorist. So go ahead, Fiorella.
No, I was just going to say, this started with, you could go back to the election. That's when we started getting strikes, when we started questioning the legitimacy of the elections. First Bernie Sanders, and of course the 2020 elections, which I'm not even going to talk about because, again, I don't want to get you in trouble. So, but like, when we started questioning that, and then of course early on in 2020 when we started questioning COVID, that's when all of this started, and January 6th as well. Also, of course, as you recall, the Hunter Biden story,
right,
that people got taken off Twitter. So this has been a long time coming, and now because the Ukraine-Russia situation, I think, is the next sort of, you know, PSYOP. And by PSYOP, I mean like the next sort of thing that they're trying to manipulate people to believe a certain narrative, just like they've done in previous times. People are finally starting to see through it, and they're pushing back more against it. So now they're going after just everybody down the line. People are getting strikes for old videos that are 2 years old. And so that just signals that, okay, now like too many of you are know too much. And if you have under like 200,000 subscribers, like Pasta says all the time, you're primed to just get knocked out. And even channels that are tiny, tiny, that don't have a lot of subscribers, maybe a couple thousand, they don't want them to grow. Because what they're seeing is people like you and others who have a huge following are absolutely getting these more popular because people want to hear that. You could talk about The Rising, right? And see every time Kim Iverson's on and she's challenging the COVID narrative or challenging the Russia, anti-Russia narrative, the views are much higher. And so they can't help that. They can't help that people want content that is truthful, that isn't formulaic like CNN and MSNBC. This is why the CNN Plus thing failed. So they're seeing like the rise of independent media, and they're seeing also people see through this bullshit. So they have to shut it down, and now they're not going to let it grow at any given point. And even Max Blumenthal, Gray Zone, just got a video taken down as well that we found out earlier today. I didn't even know about it. So
yeah, people like Farron Franzak, Farron Balanced. She got removed. She got demonetized the other day. She used to work for Fiorella's outlet for quite some time. Roar Media got taken down. You know, our friends over at Slow Newsday for years just in the penalty box. So this is all a group of people. And it used to be, you know, these other things you can talk about. But that was always the problem. Like for me, I always link it back to Julian Assange. You know, they were never going after Julian Assange. They were always coming after us. They were just using Julian to get to us. So yeah, back in the days, people, oh, it's elections, you can't talk elections. That's just the one thing. But then they moved on to COVID. Oh, it's just elections and COVID. Now you can't talk about that. Now it's what? Foreign policy? So it's going to just keep going and going and going. Mm-hmm. And it's never going to stop until we make it stop.
Well, it's okay to question the 2016 election till the cows come home, and you can even blame it on another country. You could say a coup was committed. You could say it wasn't Donald Trump isn't a legitimate president, which is what Hillary Clinton actually said. You can say all that stuff about the 2016 election, but you can't say that about the 2020 election. It's just curious to me. I wonder why that is.
Because you can't question the ruling class, right? Like if you ever question the ruling class, that's what it's about. I mean, they were going to have what was the board that they were going to put Nina Jankowicz on?
When she was coming
out completely saying, you know, as a true statement that the Hunter Biden laptop was Russian disinformation.
So she was herself, of course, spreading disinformation, which is why we have free speech. And the antidote to bad speech is better speech. It's not censorship.
That was Jimmy Dore with guest Kurt Metzger, Fiorella Isabel, and Greg Pastor Jardula.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
That was Bob Marley and the Wailers, Get Up, Stand Up. This is Pacifica's Covered Race in Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. Surveillance was a threat to women in states with laws limiting the accessibility of abortion before Roe v. Wade was overturned. And now, the threat is even greater. We spoke to Yadi Yonse of the Oakland Privacy Working Group. Yadi, could you give us a summary of the way that surveillance threatens women seeking abortion?
Yeah, so I'm going to turn this question a little bit on its head and say that surveillance threatens people seeking abortion just the way that surveillance threatens people in generally, including people that are trying to do protest, journalists, people of certain gender and sexual preferences, migrants, and people that are of low income. So in a way, the way to think about it is that surveillance state is basically primed for criminalized abortion and monitoring pregnant people.
Okay, the Centers for Disease Control collects data nationally on women who have abortions. Is there any way that authorities in states with abortion bans could get their hands on that data?
Yes, absolutely, it's possible. At the end of the day, if law enforcement or other agencies want that information, there is a way for them to obtain that, whether it's before it gets to CDC or from the CDC. So one of the key questions here is how authorities are going to prioritize who they want to prosecute, if it's going to be individuals that have already sought an abortion and trying to reactively prosecute these individuals, or is it going to be other methods of surveillance that will be more proactively and in real time monitoring people that may be seeking an abortion and trying to prevent that from happening in real time?
Could you describe other forms of surveillance that might be used to gather evidence for prosecutions of women seeking abortions, either within states that ban them or prosecutions of women who have crossed into states to get abortions then where it's legal, then return to states where it's illegal?
Yeah, so there's many things that are used to surveil people. And one thing I want to bring up is how the conversation online seems to be about women protecting their information in menstruation apps, and they're encouraged to either delete these period tracking apps or choose a more privacy-friendly app. But the reality is that there are many ways that people can be surveilled, and the information such as seeking abortions can be extracted. And that is in conversations, purchases, travel, and more specifically to the tech side is your online searches, your emails, your text, mail, physical mail, and your activity on social media.
Some women have already been prosecuted because of surveillance within the states that ban abortions. I've read that a woman in Granger, Indiana, was actually prosecuted and sent to prison in 2015 because she took abortion drugs, and that the prosecutor used data from her cell phone and iPad to build a case against her. And she was ultimately released after public outcry and a long legal battle. But do you have any idea how often this sort of thing has already happened?
So this is a very interesting case to look at because, as you highlighted, the information that was on her cell phone and her iPad was used as evidence in seeking prosecution against her. You also have to see that the landscape for prosecuting people seeking abortions before the fall of Roe v. Wade was different than the current climate. And so there will be other cases that you can search, which will serve more of an anecdotal function in looking at how law enforcement may find evidence to help with the prosecution of someone seeking abortion or other related services. However, now that the laws are changing and in some states it's actually being encouraged for people to be actively trying to seek and point out who is trying to seek an abortion, who has sought an abortion, we're going to start seeing a lot more of these cases.
Do you have any idea what might trigger the police to look into a particular woman's case? I mean, half the population is female, are women. What would make police decide that they're going to study some one woman's Facebook page or cell phone exchanges or Instagram, iPad, whatever?
So in a way, because of the advances of technology, the ways are almost limitless. So On the technology side, I'm going to focus on two specific things that law enforcement can use. The first is using a keyword warrant. Keyword warrants essentially cast a dragnet that requires a provider to search its entire reserve of user data for anyone that has searched for a specific term. So you can think about people that are searching for how to get an abortion, searching for the drug mifepristone or other abortion-related terminology. And so, for example, the police can ask Google for the name of everyone who searched for the address of an abortion provider in a state where abortions are now illegal. They can also ask for information of people who are searching for specific drugs related to abortions. They can ask for information of people who search for gender-affirming healthcare providers in a state that basically implies that seeking gender-affirming healthcare is the equivalent of child abuse. And as an example, there's a case in Colorado, People versus Seymour, that is perhaps the first U.S. case that is talking about the constitutionality of a keyword warrant. There's another example called a geofence warrant, and they require companies to provide information on every electronic device within a geographical area during any given time period. And that's just another instance of surveillance dragnet. It violates the Fourth Amendment and threatens First Amendment rights to protest, free from government spying, or suppressing media from covering critical incidents. And specifically, in the case of abortion, it can be used, for example, to pinpoint an abortion clinic and see what devices have gone in and out of those clinics and imply from there that a person has sought an abortion by the fact that they're going to an abortion clinic. And a little bit more on that is police can use warrants to collect information and movements of innocent people. And this information includes the device information, account information, email addresses, your phone numbers, services that are used by the device owner, and that's both on Android and Apple devices in terms of cell phones. So that's one thing that law enforcement can do in searching people who may be accessing abortion services. But the bigger picture is that anyone who interacts with you that you may share this information with can really be what is being called as like a bounty hunter or someone that might out you. So an employer, a colleague, a friend or family member, an Uber driver, these people all basically have the potential for becoming someone that gives information to law enforcement that you may have sought an abortion, that you may be seeking an abortion, or make a lie in terms in the situations of like domestic violence or divorce disputes as a form of retaliation.
Okay, what kind of activist organizing about this is underway?
There's a lot of organizations that are doing work in various aspects of trying to address the issues of these abortion bans. One is from the healthcare providers and trying to see how they can still provide these very important services to people. For example, there's someone in Northern California that's exploring the possibility of providing abortion services off the shores of Texas on a boat. And there's other organizations that are helping people be more aware of their digital footprint and to protect themselves from being persecuted and prosecuted if they're going to be getting an abortion. And these organizations include Oakland Privacy, EFF, Stop NY, which are very knowledgeable in the areas of surveillance and how that impacts people. And one thing that I hadn't talked about before is there may be a potential of the restriction of people with the capacity for getting pregnant from traveling between different states. And so that's really going to be interesting in how that plays out. and
Wait a minute. You're kidding me. Are you saying that anyone who is capable of being pregnant could be prevented from traveling from state to state?
Absolutely. So we have different states that are looking at this from different angles. Because there are states that are proactively saying that they want to prevent people from leaving the states that where abortion is banned and going to states where abortion is still legal, they are saying that they're going to be prosecuting women. And as a reaction, there have been some states that have been passing legislation, declaring themselves as like sanctuary states as a pushback to that. So for example, in California, Governor Newsom signed AB 1666. That was a piece of legislation by Assemblymember Rebecca Bauer-Cahan, which seeks to protect those in California from civil liability for providing, aiding, or receiving abortion care in the state. And this measure came at a time when lawmakers, for example, in the state of Missouri, were themselves advancing a proposal to allow private citizens, aka these bounty hunters, to sue any Missouri residents who went to seek an abortion at a state, as well as providers of abortions and anyone else who assists with people seeking an abortion.
Okay, is there anything else you'd like to say?
Yeah, so this talk about privacy is very important and has been embedded in different areas of our lives. And unfortunately, it's just one of those things that is kind of invisible and something that was like an implied right. And it's unfortunate that it's bubbling to the surface now and it's really in your face because of the fall of Roe v. Wade, really a protection that pregnant people have had for 50 years. And I will say that it's awful that people basically have to take a big burden onto themselves to protect their privacy, their autonomy for seeking basic healthcare services. You know, the advice out there telling people to delete their period tracking app or to clamp down on personal data shifts the burden onto people to conduct a corporate-style risk assessment of data security and a lawyer-like review of privacy policies of every tech thing they interact with. So this places expectations for people to be experts on product research and safety, Wi-Fi network security, security features like encryption and authentication, data storage and data breaches, firmware or software vulnerabilities and patches, complex passwords, how AI works, having privacy policies comprehension, and really being on top of data privacy best practices. But really, this is the time for the government to step up and protect these really basic rights of individuals that is going to be affecting not just them personally, but their families and possibly generations to come. And this is not just about seeking abortion, but it's really about the freedom to travel to other states, the freedom to not have to give sensitive information to employers and to who knows what other entities, and to be having the burden to look out for yourself, to protect yourself from these very basic rights.
Okay, Yari, thank you for speaking to COVID, Race, and Democracy.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Yari Yance of the Oakland Privacy Working Group. And that concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by Polina Vasiliev and myself, Ann Garrison. The executive producers of CRD are Akua Holt, Polina Vasiliev, and Steve Seltzer. Instrumental music was King Clave, Planet Drum Song, featuring Mickey Hart, from Playing for Change Around the World. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD and on Facebook at COVID, Race, and Democracy. I've been your host, Ian Garrison. Thanks for listening.